You are listening to Reboot, the Evan Higgins story on WRKC Wilkes-Barre. This documentary, written and produced by King's student Jessica Mulligan with assistance from Higgins, a 2014 graduate of King's College, explores his recovery after a near-fatal car accident in 2009.
I don't really get emotional about it. It just, it happened. Gotta get through it.
The fact that he's almost fully recovered is kind of a miracle.
Basically, just a regular kid, you know, fun to be around.
To his credit, never whimpered or bellyached about anything. Never. I had a saying at the hospital. I said, Evan, you teach me, I'll teach you, and we'll learn this together.
I do think he's overcome it in a miraculous way.
Even though it was a sad situation, you couldn't feel sad just because of the way that he was handling it and the way he was getting better.
He just wanted to be accepted for who he was now and not keep looking back to who he was in the past.
Hi, I am Evan Higgins. I used to live here at this Ronald McDonald House in the summer of 2009 for 2 months. When I was 17 years old, in January of 2009, I was in a near-fatal car accident. I was rushed to Christiana Hospital, and the doctor proceeded with removing both sides of my skull to relieve pressure on my brainstem. My traumatic brain injury was very severe. I had frontal lobe and right side lobe brain damage and bleeds on my brain. The thought I was not going to live through the surgery. My best case scenario was that I would be bedridden with tubes for the rest of my life. I was in a wheelchair for nearly 6 months and had to relearn everything.
Evan Higgins is a son, brother, and friend. Evan Higgins is a graduating marketing major of King's College. Evan Higgins is a miracle. After a car accident his senior year in high school caused him to almost lose his life, Evan Higgins had to begin fresh, physically, mentally, and educationally. In his youth, 7 had always been his lucky number. Now, 7 people will tell his story of hope and overcoming obstacles, beginning with his father, Bob Higgins.
My pager went off because I'm a volunteer firefighter, EMT in town. And usually when the pager goes off, you just get up and go. For some reason, I got up and I paused and said, "Ugh, I'm too tired." And I went back in bed. 20 minutes later, my daughter, Hallie, comes running up the stairs. She goes, Dad, Evan was in an accident. Oh, and I woke up with a chill. And I just had that feeling it wasn't a good day. And I went downstairs, and there was a state trooper there, and the chief of police was there from our town. And I asked them, naturally, how's Evan doing? And they said, well, he's in the ambulance, and we were just kind of directing traffic, so I really couldn't tell you because they took him away, and you just need to get over to Christiana Hospital. And they weren't really answering my question, and I knew that when there's two officers, it's a fatality. They always send two officers at a fatal accident, I guess in case the people get so upset that it's more than handle for one cop, so they always send two cops for a fatality. So that since they said that he was in the ambulance, I figured, well, maybe he isn't dead yet. And so I said, what's the car look like? You know, I could give two hoots what the car looked like. But they knew, as a firefighter and doing other extrications, that if I knew what the car looked like, I could pretty much put two and two together and know what injuries he had. Oh, we were just taking care of traffic. We didn't really see it, Bob. You need to just get over to the hospital. So from them not telling me, I knew it was pretty grave. So before we even left the driveway, I just had a gut feeling. I said, this is all going to be on me. I just felt that. And we dropped our daughter off, and we went right over to Christiana Hospital, and we went down to the trauma unit. The social worker brought us down there, and we get down the end of the hall. You know, you're expecting to see, like, the beds with the drapes and, you know, how bandaged up is he, you know? That's what you're preparing yourself for. And we get down the end, and I look at the side of the door, and I said to my wife, I said, Jill, this is not a good sign. This is a conference room. This is not a good sign. I just want you to prepare yourself. So we went into the conference room. Like 2 seconds after that, the doctor and a nurse and another social worker came in, and he introduced himself. Hi, I'm Dr. Sugarman. As you know, your son was in a vehicle accident, and the paramedics gave him all the medication to reduce the swelling in the brain. Our trauma unit has done the same, but his cerebellum is swelling and pressing down on his brainstem, and we don't expect him to live. My wife just kind of falls back in the chair and looks at me and says, you know, like, you deal with it. I can't. You deal with it. So I said to Dr. Sugarman, I said, well, he says, the only thing we can do is perform a life-saving operation and remove his bone flaps to let the brain expand. And we don't expect him to live through that operation. And I said, well, have you given him all the medication you could to reduce the swelling? And he says, yes. I said, then do it. And as he's leaving the room, he's turning around, pointing one finger in the air, said, you're doing the right thing. If it was my son, I'd be doing the exact same operation, and went out of the room. I never knew that you could cry to a point where nothing came out. But after 10 hours, the neurosurgeon came out, and he said, Evan's vitals were strong the whole operation. We really had no problems. He had some bleeds, and he does have some subdural hematomas, which are other bleeds deep down that they can't get. So what they basically do is take suction off any blood that's right there, or dried up blood. But when he mentioned bone flaps before, I didn't know what a bone flap was. I had no idea. Well, now I know what a flap is. When he did the operation, it's called a bilateral decompressive craniectomy. And what they do, this particular doctor removes the whole side of the skull, size of your hand, on both sides. So Evan had what eventually looked like, once the swelling went down, eventually looked like a very strange mohawk. But the mohawk was just his bone, because there was no bone next to it, and it was all sunken in next to it. And so the doctor said, but his vitals were strong, and we removed the bleeds, and you should be able to go up and see him in ICU in about a half an hour. So we went up there, and he was just all bandaged up. Naturally, he was still unresponsive. I think they might have even had him medically under just so he could start healing. So for some reason, I don't know why, but I asked the doctor, I said, Dr. Sugarman, from all your years of experience, he's been doing this for 30 years. I said, and seeing how strong his vitals were, the whole operation never wavered. If you could give a prognosis, what would you say? He says, I'm cautiously optimistic, just like that. And I told that story to a friend of ours who was an ER nurse for 18 years. She said, are you kidding me? She goes, you know what you need a pry bar just to get that out of the neurosurgeon 2 weeks after the operation, let alone a half hour after he's done. And she thought that was unbelievable. But that was his first reaction, and that's what he said.
Evan, however, remembers it differently, if he remembers it at all.
I don't really remember much about the car accidents. I just know that I was snowboarding with my friend Ryan prior to the car accident. I asked him where Wawa was, and he told me the directions, and that's when the car accident happened. I was the only one in the car. I was 17 years old. It was in January, and it was during the daytime. Or actually, yeah, I'm not sure. Daytime, I think. Yeah, somewhere around that. From the recovery process, I remember having to go to therapy when I stayed at DuPont Hospital for 5 months approximately, and I had to do physical therapy, speech therapy, and occupational therapy. It was pretty frustrating not knowing how to basically act, or I don't know, just it's kind of hard because I wasn't able to walk, I wasn't able to do much physical ability, and I really had like a knowledge of like a baby. It was really bad. Yeah, it was pretty tough. But I mean, I just thought through the next day and just figured, I don't know, I just kind of got over it.
The number 7 proved significant in the life of Evan, as described by both Evan and his dad.
My lucky number since I was a baby was 7. I remember when I used to live in California, I would have to be in aisle 7 with my mom. I'd have to go whenever we're at the gas station, we had to go number 7 because I was so obsessed with number 7. They told me that I wanted to move out because our house number was 24 and it wasn't 7. I wanted to move across the street because there's a 7. So they ended up putting a 7 in the back door. So I had my own little door and it said 7, and it made me happy.
And the strangest thing, when he was growing up, little guy, oh man, his favorite number was 7. We had to go through, picture this, a little kid would not let us out of the grocery store unless we went through aisle 7. There could be 20 people in that line, but we had to go through aisle 7. And if we pumped our gas out west, you have to pump your gas yourself. We had to go to pump 7. Well, lo and behold, there we are. ICU room was number 7. He was in number 7, so he was there.
The car accident was very difficult for the family, and Father Bob Higgins described the experience of not having him at home and going to see him in the hospital daily.
You go home, you're numb, you can't sleep from everything that happened. My wife had a nervous breakdown from everything. She got to a point where she couldn't even sleep. She would just shake in bed. It was really difficult to try to wake her up to get over to the hospital in the morning. And the first thing I wanted to do was be there. If they say you can come in at 10, I wanted to be there at 9:30. You know, I was like chomping at the bit to get in there. There was a lot of miracles that happened just to get them to that place. And other miracles happened once we got to DuPont. Certain things just fell into place, and they just came when you really needed it and when you really prayed for it. So I immediately, after a couple of days of being at the ICU, I started moving all his joints and what I could. He had to get past the 72-hour threshold because they still don't know if you're going to live. If you get past the 72 hours, well, then there's a good chance that you're going to live. And his hands were just flopping, moving any which direction. But they have what's called, is when the person moves in towards their body, it's a good sign. They call it purposeful movement. But when they flail their hands away from their body, that's a bad sign, because that means things aren't connecting. Because the natural instinct is to bring your arms and limbs in. So at first, he wasn't out or in. He was just flailing up and down. So he wasn't one way or the other. And then he was starting to try to pull tubes out, catheters. So that was a good sign. Even though it was bad, what he was doing was a good sign, because he had what they called purposeful movement. He was doing that for a reason. He didn't want a catheter in. So he wanted it out, so that your body's telling you, get rid of it. So they had to start tying him down. Because he also just had his head wrapped in dressing with a drain from fluid buildup. And he knew my wife's hand. He wouldn't touch just anybody's hand. But when he felt my wife's ring, he knew it was her for some reason, or it seemed that way. So he always held her hand. So he had to be there for 12 days. So after he made it past the 72-hour, he still had a broken collarbone, which they couldn't set, because after a 10-hour operation, they were just going to make him live first. So then after he got past that, then they went in, they put a pin, it's about 7-8 inches through his collarbone, to set his bone in place. Normally, they wouldn't even do that, because they would just normally hold a person in a sling and that would heal on its own, but he wouldn't be able to hold it in a sling, so they had to pin it. And then they put a feeding tube in, and they put a trach in, but they pretty much had a trach from the operation anyway. So every day I would end up just taking my own car, because my wife couldn't even wake up. Because you wake up and you want to think, was that just a dream? Maybe it wasn't real. But then reality sets in and you say, no, it was real. And you just walk around with like a pit in your gut 24 hours a day, or as long as you're awake.
One piece of advice that proved significant to both Evan and his father was from Dr. Sugarman, as told by Bob Higgins.
The doctor came in, Dr. Sugarman, and he said to us, he says, this is the most difficult time right now. Not for Evan, for you, the parents. Evan's going to heal, and however he heals is on his own time there. But what's the hard part is for the parents. He says, because the only advice I can give you is this, and I pretty much held to this advice throughout the whole time, and to a certain extent, I still do. Dr. Sugarman had said to him, he says, don't look back and don't look too far ahead. Give yourself maybe a few days or a week, and that'll keep you right here in the present where you need to be to help Evan with all his daily needs. That'll keep you focused on him. And I pretty much live by that, only because you start looking back to start saying, well, what if this or what if that? What if, you can't change anything.
As time progressed, Bob Higgins stayed overnight in the hospital to be with his son, something Evan himself had mixed opinions about.
So I decided I was going to stay there with him 24/7. And so I just used all my sick time and all my vacation time. So I decided I was going to live there with him. So I started living there 24/7. And at night, I would tie his left hand to the bed. It's a highwayman's knot. It's a firefighter's knot. You can pull on one side of it till the cows come home. And that thing's never going to, it's only going to get tighter. Pulling the other cord, barely even pulling it, it comes loose. It's a safety nut. So that if for some reason they had to get him out real quick, all they do is pull the other side and he's loose. And so one side I tie him to the bed and I tie the other to my wrist and to his wrist. So that if I fell asleep and he went for his head, he'd wake me up. So he would, and I never gave him that much rope. I mean, it was a cord. It was a hospital cord. And I never gave him that much so that he would pull me. But my brother says, Bob, you can't stay awake for 7 weeks. Because it was going to be 7 weeks before he got his bone back in. That was the other thing about the bone. When they take the bone out, they usually implant it in the person's abdomen to preserve it. Because the body won't destroy its own thing. But since Evan was planning on coming to Kings to be a swimmer, and he was captain of a swim team, he swam his whole life. He was always in the pool, even during the winter. He had zero body fat. So they had nowhere to put it, so they had to medically freeze it. So that once all his swelling went down, they take the bone out, they test it, and they implant it back into his head and hold it in there with titanium bolts. So anyway, I'm there. I figured I'm going to stay there. And my brother says, well, you can't stay awake for 7 weeks. I said, I'm not. I'm going to stay awake for 2 weeks. And then after that 2 weeks, I stayed awake for another 2 weeks. And I catch cat naps. You know, I'd just watch his monitor. If I saw his blood pressures and everything starting to jump up, I knew that I could be ready for something to happen.
I was definitely frustrated to have him there because I was grateful and frustrated at the same time. I wasn't aware of how grateful I was until I realized it after I recouped from my car accident. But I was frustrated because I saw him every day, every second of the day, and it just got overwhelming, and he was very protective, and it just kind of frustrated me. So once you have a time where you're with someone for such a long time, it's too much. But as you get older, you realize how grateful you are.
The injury and hospitalization of Evan Higgins proved to be very difficult for more than just Evan, according to him and Sherry Yek, who worked closely with Evan at the Academic Skills in King's College.
My family was pretty heartbroken. My mom, it hit her pretty hard, and she was like not able to function well. And my dad, it was pretty hard for him too, but he was able to fight through it.
Mom, through all this, really took a backseat. Dad took the forefront role. And, you know, Evan talked about how that really changed his whole family. Dad and the whole family came up to do a speech. Greg Janik and I were doing a presentation on concussions and traumatic brain injuries and what faculty should know. And I was enlightened because it was the first time I met his mother. She was very much just in the shadow rather than up front. And I have to say, at the end of the talk, we were open for questions, and someone asked his sister a question. She broke down and cried in front of an entire audience of people and said, "No one would believe it, but my brother's accident has completely changed my life. I lost my father because now he was solely dedicated to Evan. I lost my mother because she went within herself and didn't know how to deal with it." And so I essentially went through a few years of high school kind of on my own because everyone's 110% was to Evan or my mom to her own recovery of dealing with it. And so it was really emotional in the room and powerful for her to say, but then acknowledging that she thinks it made her a stronger, you know, better, more independent person than maybe she would have turned out to be.
Evan's mother, Jill, was able to provide commentary on her son's accident and experience through an unconventional interview, one with Evan himself.
This is my mom. I'm going to ask her a few questions. Mom, can you talk about how I was before my accident?
Well, before your accident, you were just a regular 17-year-old high school kid. You were ambitious. You enjoyed sports and swimming and golf. And you were basically just a regular kid, you know, fun to be around. That's all I can think of right now.
All right, thank you. Can you talk about when you found out about my car accident? What was your reaction?
When I found out about your car accident, I just got a sinking feeling. When the policeman came to the door, I was just like, oh my God. Like, didn't know what to think because I was afraid to think of the worst.
It's a tough time. Can you speak about your reaction towards my recovery?
Yes, I'm very pleased with your recovery. I'm excited about your recovery because I really didn't expect you to have recovered this well. I hoped it, but I didn't want to put it, I didn't want to get my hopes up too high, even though I wanted to. So I was preparing myself for your recovery being less than you are. So I'm ecstatic, very happy.
Thank you.
For Evan, the recovery process was long, but his father was there every step of the way, giving him the ability to make an analogy of exactly what it was like.
The best analogy I can give you is it was like a computer rebooting. It didn't know what to do. As the swelling was going down and he was starting to heal, his body didn't know how to regulate temperature. There would be a week or two when he would be in profusely sweating with air conditioning on. We had fans on him. And then he would go to his body would be so cold, no matter how many blankets we had on him, he was still shaking and shivering. The body just didn't know how to regulate anything at all. So there was always those up and downs. And as he continued to heal, well, the computer continued to boot up, right? You know, sometimes when your computer goes bad at home and you do something and you reboot it, it seems to start to fix itself. Well, that's what his body was doing. His mind was repairing itself.
Even as he began to wake up, the road to recovery was still long ahead of Evan Higgins, survivor of a traumatic brain injury after a car accident, as explained by his father, Bob Higgins.
The only way they could get him to talk was through pain stimuli, which was like he was laying on the mat, and they put his arm out, just held it out, and you could see his face crunching up like it hurt. And they weren't really stretching anything. Just the fact that they had it up was enough for him. And they said, does that hurt? And he would shake his head. And they said, well, tell us, does it hurt? And he wouldn't say anything. So they kept stretching it until he finally said, yes. He finally said, yes. And they said, okay. And then they said, well, what do you want us to do? Do you want us to put your arms down? They didn't put his arms down. And finally says yes. So that was the first time he got to talk. And they weren't doing anything that was hurting him. Although to him, it probably might have felt pain because he hasn't been used to using his arms. And so he progressed from that. This one time, it was like, I guess it was 3 o'clock in the morning or something like that. And I always would park myself right next to his bed in one of those little kind of lounge chairs. And I always worked the midnight shift. And the doctors were even saying, Mr. Higgins, you can't stay up all night. I said, I worked the midnight shift. I stay up night every night. I've done it for 10 years. You know, it's like, and I would always go home and do projects at home, split firewood, do something. You know, I'd probably slept 4 or 5 hours a day anyway. And so I said, I think at a certain point they wanted, I don't know if they wanted Evan out as much as they wanted me out of there. But it was about 3 o'clock in the morning. Evan looks up and he looks over the side of the bed and goes, who the hell are you? I said, Evan, I'm your father. No, you're not. Don't you lie to me. You're lying to me. Because I don't know who you are. I don't want you here. I said, Evan, I'm your father. I said, what do you think, I'm a hired hand? And he said, yeah. And I said, Evan, you were in a car accident. You're safe, but you're in the hospital. And I'm your father, and I've been here with you every day, 24 hours a day. Well, I don't want anything to happen to me. I said, nothing's going to happen to you. And he says, well, I might fall out of the bed and die. And I said, you're not going to fall out of the bed and die because I'm going to be here. So then he still didn't know who I was. And that was like 3 months after. And I told the doctors. So then because of that fear, they have what's called a posy bed. That's the manufacturer. What it is, it's a net that goes over the bed. And they can't fall out of it because you have to zip them in every night and get them out. And it gives them that security. They know that they're not going to fall out. So then he had to go to a posy bed for almost to the time that we left. They had to make him sit in a shell, which I clamped in every morning, which would allow him to sit up straight. Otherwise, he had no muscle to hold his back up. So this was further down the line. But initially, basically, there was things at night to do. He had a book. You had to read through things because he didn't know who he was or anything. So I would just spend every morning, very first thing, I'd clean all the sutures. And since he was on a trach, you build up this what's called thrush in the mouth because the saliva isn't there to bacteria build up. So I had a little solution I made with mouthwash and baking soda and or peroxide, and just lightly brush it to keep his mouth clean. I'd clean his around his trach. I'd clean his feeding tube, and any other cleaning he needed throughout the night. He was always taken care of. He never waited till the nurses made the rounds and you know cleaned him up from for any reason. So I figured if I was there and did all of that and prevented any other infection, then all he has to do is fight what happened to him and let his head heal. His body doesn't have to fight anything else. He didn't have skin breakdown. He didn't have anything. And so I just did that every day. And every single day, the therapist would come in and look at me. What are you doing, Mr. Higgins? I said, I'm moving his muscles. I'd move every single finger, his hand, his arm, his leg. I would move it every single day. And as time went on, he started to be able to, he opened his eyes. And I remember that day when he did that. He didn't know who I was. He didn't know who anybody was. So I had a book there with all his friends' pictures in it. And I asked him, who's this and who's this? And so that was all the things you had to keep doing every single day. It was a repetition. And I always told him, oh, I can be a real ratchet jaw sometimes talking, but I would tell him throughout the whole day. I'd say, Evan, just want to let you know, you're in a car accident, you're okay, you're safe, but you had an injury and you're in a hospital right now, but you're safe, and I want you to know that. They said that if you keep doing that, it reassures the person, you know, because they don't know where they're at. They have no idea where they're at. So basically, I would say that to him every single day and throughout the whole day. And until finally it got to a point, he says, you know, this is much further down the line. Don't tell me that anymore. But he was determined to try to get himself better. I think by the fourth month, he recognized people in our photo album. He knew where it was. And still didn't know who I was, but he knew my wife, he knew his mom, he knew Hallie, and my brother Bill, retired state trooper. He was over there every single day. And you know, just picture a cop, you know, a cop's there, come on, Evan, what's my name. I said, Bill, I said, what, are you going to interrogate him? I said, you know, but that was his nature. And he goes, come on, say Uncle Bill. So finally, Evan just goes, Uncle Bill, you know, just to clam him up. But he still didn't know who I was. And I guess it wasn't until like four and a half months after he kind of knew who I was for whatever reason. But at any rate, he was determined to learn how to walk so that he could get back to his high school and walk up with his graduating class. That's what he wanted to do. He came a long way. He had to relearn everything in his entire life. Everything, how to shower, how to go to the bathroom, how to eat. They had to do a special swallow test where you can actually, they give him certain foods and they have an x-ray machine up against his neck where you can, they actually see to make sure that all everything's moving and the food is going down. And unless he passes that swallow test, he's not going to get to eat. He was on liquid food. So Evan was pretty much, he was always a negotiator. Maybe that's why he's in business here. But he was, even little, he always watched CSNBC. He didn't want to see Sesame Street. He wanted to see the ticker tape. And so basically the pathologist said, we have somebody from Temple University. They want to do a study. They hardly ever have an adult here. So we want to be able to videotape you. And Evan said, well, if you let me have a hamburger, I'll do it. And she goes, well, Evan, you have to have puree food right now. You're not ready for a hamburger. Well, they're going to have to find somebody else then. So he was always negotiating. He was negotiating for a hamburger. So they kind of, the pathologist just gave him notes, but he didn't want to do a video because he didn't get his deal. So, but that's his personality anyway, though.
As he continued to recover, Evan showed interesting signs such as nervous laughter, which was labeled by one of his doctors.
I think he phrased it as a mental inhabitation, which is basically that my neurons are all messed up because the car accident with the collision moved my neurons, and people with brain injuries, after their first few years, they tend to laugh more or do unusual things. So it's kind of normal that was happening.
Throughout the extensive recovery process, two of his best friends from high school recalled having both feelings of sadness and humor over their friendship with Evan and watching him struggle through his recovery.
Hi, this is Evan. I'm doing an interview with my friend Jordan. We've been friends since 7th grade. I'm going to ask him a few questions. Can you discuss knowing me while I was in high school? You can talk about my personality and athletics.
Evan was a friendly guy. He loved sports and could tell you anybody's record or foul balls or any other stuff that he liked. He was a swimmer, and I think he did tennis, but mostly he did swimming. So he was like one of the fastest people on our team. He swam for Shalik, our high school, from like freshman year all the way up to senior year. I joined the swim team on senior year and was on racing along with Evan for a while until his accident. He loves to say that he was the number one swimmer.
Can you discuss what your reaction was about my car accident?
We were shocked. Like, I found out through a text message from another teammate. The school wasn't really giving us that much information, so we were all just wondering what had happened to Ev. We're kind of bummed out. Practices weren't going too well because we just didn't know what was going on. We were kind of kept in the dark for a while.
Can you discuss your reaction towards my recovery?
We were actually surprised because at first they told us that Evan would be somewhat of a vegetable, and the fact that he's almost fully recovered is kind of a miracle. He's walking, talking, and basically is the same kid that we used to know, so that's like a good thing. Not expected, so it's kind of good to have my friend back.
Hi, this is my friend Matt. Been friends with him since I was in third grade. I'm gonna ask him a few questions. Can you discuss knowing me in high school? You can speak about my athletics and personality.
Okay, so growing up, I mean, we always played in the neighborhood. We always had, you know, bikes out. We were always very active. It wasn't too much time that you really spent inside. The only time that you were inside was usually when you're watching sports, something like that. You put a ton of concentration into swimming. I mean, you were always joking around. That was like the biggest thing with you, was that no matter how serious you were, you always made people laugh. You did literally the goofiest things ever. And I'm not sure if we were laughing with you or at you sometimes, but either way, I mean, generally when you were in a room, you brought a smile to whoever was there. I mean, that was definitely one of the most positive things, when you can have a friend in a group that always makes anyone laugh no matter what time it is. So to see someone that athletic, I mean, and to have that great of a personality was definitely something unique.
Can you discuss when you found out about my car accident and what was your reaction?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, like I said, we grew up together. So I was actually away at college when I found out. It definitely sucked. I was over at Liberty University, so it was about 6.5 hours away. I actually came home the next weekend just to kind of see what was going on. Got to visit him at the DuPont Hospital. That was right after one of his brain surgeries that he had. And that was when they cut out the skull. They cut out both sides of it. So there was just a middle piece like a mohawk, and the center piece was like, it sucked to his head and it looked really weird. Freaked me out. I can't do medical stuff, so it took a lot for me to go in there. I mean, it was definitely it was definitely a tearjerker just when you see one of your best friends in that critical of condition. He couldn't even talk. All he could do was moan and cry. And, like, that was really hard for, like, anybody seeing that, especially when you see a family that, like, you're so close with. It was definitely a hard road, even though I wasn't always there. Like, I would come home on weekends to kind of try and visit him in the hospital, and was always calling home to ask about him because, I mean, that's just one of your best friends. You don't want to see anyone go through that, especially when it's an accident with cars. I mean, it wasn't like he was out there doing anything stupid. He wasn't out there partying. Like, it wasn't even anything like that. So when you see something happen to someone who's so focused in a sport and really just advancing themselves and having good, honest fun, it just sucks when you see that.
Can you speak about your reaction towards my recovery?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, your recovery was probably the most shocking thing I think anyone's ever seen. Like I said, just to see you missing part of your skull and to see you just being able to kind of like make sounds and really just cry. Like to see you go from that to like when I'd come home on vacation and stuff, you'd be over there like laughing like, hey, I tried running today up the steps and go figure, I hit the door. You know, like he was always setting goals like, you know, hey, I walked 10 steps today or I hit on a nurse. I think she winked back. I mean, there wasn't any point in time where it really stopped him from thinking of being better. I mean, he kept his personality. He was the goofiest kid ever. He was hitting on everybody, trying to pull out dates, you know. And it was the funniest thing when he would tell you the story because, you know, here he is rolling around in a wheelchair like, hey, I winked at this girl today. Pretty sure she noticed me. You know, like he would be laughing the entire time. So it was really, even though it was a sad situation, you couldn't feel sad just because of the way that he was handling it and the way he was getting better. And I mean, I remember when he sent me the first video of him running down the street. I mean, he was so pumped and I mean, it was awesome. He went from barely being able to make even like sentences and he'd be asking you what he was trying to say and you'd be like, I have no idea, to like now where he's in college. I mean, he's working towards graduating, getting good grades, actually getting dates now, which is definitely a plus. So I mean, it was just all in all, I mean, it was a phenomenal recovery.
Is there anything else you'd want to say?
Oh yeah, when he used to text, it was the most brutal thing to try and read. I mean, you would have no idea what was going on. It was like the Morse code trying to decipher that crap. And I mean, now he texts full sentences, which is a lot easier to read. I remember one story, actually. We have a bonfire pit behind my house, and we invited him to come out. So he's walking back to the bonfire pit, and he was so focused on walking that he forgot to watch out for the three bushes.
It was also late.
Oh, yeah, he was late, so he was trying
I'm saying that it's dark out.
Yeah, oh, yeah, it was night, but, I mean, he was trying to rush back there, and when he was walking, he was looking at me because I said something to him. And he didn't hear me say, it's a bush, Evan. And I was just, falls on his face, gets back up, looks around, see who saw. And he's like, all right, we're good. And I was like, Evan, there's another bush. But he wouldn't listen to me because he was so focused on other things. And he trips over that bush and got back up and goes for the third bush and fell again. Finally, he was like to me. And I was like, well, at this point, don't worry. There's no more bushes. But it's definitely been a few falls, a few bruises, but definitely good to have him back, to have him back in the group too. Everyone from high school usually that we all hung with in our town really hangs out. We always go to the bonfires and stuff like that, so definitely nice to have him back in that. That's all I got.
While his family and friends were essential to helping him along in the process toward recovery, one song in particular also inspired him as he related to both the lyrics and the message.
There was a song that was actually on my iPod before my car accident. It was Simple Plan, and the song was called Untitled. And basically, that song, like all the lyrics, is pretty much exactly what I went through. And I would just listen to it because I just reminisced thinking like what I went through. And the lyrics was basically identical. And I remember showing my uncle that song, and he said, why would you want to listen to such a depressing song? And I'm just like, I don't know, it has meaning because I can relate to every single word in the lyrics.
Even with everything that had happened, Evan was still determined to walk with his graduating class at graduation.
Evan, even though he wasn't going to graduate from high school, it was his senior year in January when it happened. He was still determined to walk up with his class. He had like a couple health classes and a couple other things that were state requirements. So he had to go back just to do the state requirements. Even though he had enough credits to graduate, they were mandatory. So I had mentioned that to him, and I said, I never BS'd him. I was always right up front with him, and I told him that, I tried to find the right moment. And I said, hey, Evan, in order for you to get back to where you were, there you're going to have to repeat 12th grade and go through the special education classes and stuff and to help you out to get you back to where you should be. And he was upset, and he goes, well, am I going to be able to swim? And I said, well, I don't know, because there's an 8-semester rule from the New Jersey Interscholastic Athletic Association. There's a 8-semester rule where you can't participate in a high school sport more than 8 semesters. because years ago, they used to have kids, hey, flunk the grade and let's have another championship team and we'll take care of you, you know. And it's like, so they put a rule in that says you can't go any more than 8 semesters. And I said, well, I don't know if that will be allowed, but what I will do is I promise you I'll try to do everything I can all the way to the end. And he goes, okay. So he was determined to try to go walk up with his graduating class. So he saw somebody stand up for like 5 seconds and then sit back down. And he says, I want to do that. He still wasn't able to walk. This was like 3.5-4 months after. And so he kept asking, what time is Becky? Becky was the physical therapist. What time? I said, Ev, you should know this because we have to go over your plan every day, because he had to recite every single night what he did. And he had to keep rebuilding and the repetition until everything started working again. And as soon as he got into Becky, he says, Becky, I want to start walking. She goes, well, as soon as you get a little stronger, we'll get you up. He goes, no, I want to walk right now. And she says, well, okay. And so they got one of those big walkers where it has the hand grips on the top, like old folks would use, and for an adult size. And he stood up, and his legs were shaking like a jackrabbit, but he had a grin from ear to ear because he was so happy. Just to be able to stand there. She goes, all right, sit down. He says, no, I'm not done yet. And he just kept standing there.
The experience of returning to high school was unlike any Evan could have anticipated.
I was a graduate at my high school in 2009. I had all the credits to pass to graduate, but I still needed to pass gym and health class because I didn't complete the second semester of my senior year in high school. So the option was either to graduate or be considered still a student because I didn't pass those two courses. We decided that it was best to go back to high school where I was placed in the special needs class, and I eventually did tutoring because I was not ready to go to college at that time period because I was just starting in my tutoring. I was doing a lot of addition, subtraction, multiplication, division, and a little bit of algebra. And then I did a lot of reading and grammar. I did reading, writing, and learned vocabulary. So that was a good fit so I can prepare me to college. I remember in June, they, I forget who they are, basically like the disabled people, they have their little thing for disabilities and stuff like that, and they came to watch me when I was in the schooling at DuPont Hospital, and they're like, they figured I'd be like in a special needs class, so they put me in a special needs class, and it was couple months later when I started school in September, and it was completely inappropriate, and I was like way ahead of everyone else. And basically they're so the teacher, it was actually pretty funny because my friend, that was his mom, and she was excited to get to know me and stuff like that, but she felt that it'd be best if I was not in the special needs class because it was not appropriate. Like after the first day, she just like, okay, I think he might need a change. And then after the fourth day, she just said, yeah, you're too ahead of these kids. So got moved. At first I got put in a regular class, not college prep, a level below college prep where I used to do my classes, and it was regular. And I used to do regular classes, but then I did that for about a month and a half. But then because I was still getting my brain better, because it was less than a year after my near fatal car accident with a severe traumatic brain injury, which I guess I was pretty far ahead where I was supposed to be compared to what the doctors were saying. And I did regular classes, but after the 6 weeks or so, I remember doing tests and I couldn't remember it. And the thing was, I passed those classes before. I already passed them. I was just retaking it. And we felt that it was best for me to do school tutoring instead with my aide, Mr. Cassidy, and the teacher who was selected to tutor me. She was a high school teacher for a long time, and then she ended up teaching at the community college, so they thought it'd be a good fit so they can get me ready for college. So I had school tutoring instead, and I remember I still had gym and health class with the special needs kids, and they really liked me and stuff. They really liked me, and I don't know, they just really liked me and they really liked me and looked up to me. And I remember there's one kid who was autistic, and he didn't really like men. He didn't really like guys, and he would only like talk to, or he'd only like or talk to me and my my aide, because I had to have an aide because I wasn't able to walk really that great, and if I was to fall, the school would be sued. So I had to walk with an aide whenever I walked in the hallway, which is pretty cool.
Evan Higgins' decision to go to King's College was mostly based on swimming, but he was happy to be there for more reasons than that.
Well, I chose to come to King's because when I was a senior in high school, I was scouted and I was going to come to King's College to swim for their swim team. And I got a scholarship and a grant. I did not do any swimming here at King's, but I just swim on occasions and just swim for fun because it's not really my passion anymore. I remember when I was in the hospital, it was in March. I got accepted to King's College because I got a grant so I can swim competitively for King's College. But the car accident obviously limited me from doing that in 2009. After I found out from my dad that I accepted to King's College, I was excited because they wanted me to swim there for the class of 2013. But the car accident kind of limited me from going to King's College a year prior. My car accident kind of limited me from going to King's College in 2009 rather than 2010. But it was my goal because I really wanted to competitively swim again, and that was my focus because in physical therapy, I did aquatic therapy in the pool because they knew I was a swimmer. So I started walking in the pool and swimming because I really enjoyed swimming, and that was a main goal of mine, to keep on swimming. When I first came to King's, it was kind of overwhelming because I had to make sure I had good grades, and also I wanted to have a social life because it was like a fresh new start because I was isolated in my house for a year and a half, not being able to do much after the car accident. So I mean, it was really fun. I was smiling and everything.
Evan's journey at King's College was also very influenced by the academic skills and Sherry Yek, who spoke of when Evan first arrived.
She was pretty helpful because she's like the head person for the academic skills program. And in the freshman year, I came to her, had to come meetings with her and basically tell her what's going on to make sure I'm on the right track to get good grades. And academic skills is a good program. I can take tests there and get tutoring and stuff like that. So
the academic skills program seemed like it would help me a lot in my first year in college when I needed to. When I needed to adapt to a college life and do well in school.
When Evan came in, he still had a lot of visual scarring that would be evident to people. You could still see that his hair was growing in over, at that point, an open skull with only skin over it. So at first, we had to deal with a lot of concern and anxiety on he and his family's part, because a simple tripping over someone's foot and falling could be an open head wound all over again for him and could significantly change his life. And at that point, he was still very medically fragile, physically fragile, had difficulty walking longer distances. You could see a true evident difference in his gait and his posture and things at first. So he came to us very nervous, very anxious, but definitely determined. He and Dad really felt the need to always show pictures and, you know, want to really tell that whole story to everyone they met initially. Evan was willing to do that with me, but quickly found Dad wanted to do that with every professor and every person they met. And so I think a role of mine initially for freshman year was teaching Dad that Evan no longer wanted to provide those details. He didn't want his peers to know the hardcore, you know, facts of what happened to him. He just wanted to be accepted for who he was now and not keep looking back to who he was in the past.
At the end of his 4 years at King's College, Sherry Yek was further able to provide a testament of his growth and evolution.
He went from someone who, you know, came here scared and afraid and didn't want to acknowledge anything to Here I am. I've made it. He's been through several surgeries along the way, even during, you know, college. Two, I'm going to own it. I've just, you know, realized here's who I am and here's my limitation, and I'm going to go with it. He probably has mentioned he definitely really has made a career decision that he will involve his injury in whatever career path he goes into. So we've spent a lot of time talking about that and how he might change, you know, his experience into something positive for other people.
Evan also spent time at Moss Rehab, where he was discouraged, but felt this only pushed him further toward success.
After the first month, I was concentrating more on my social life rather than my schoolwork, and I realized they're kind of right now because I'm not doing that well in college, and I need to step my game up. So I got really angry, and I wrote Moss Rehab on a little card and put it on my desk so I would look at it to make sure I stayed motivated to get good grades. And I brought all my grades up and didn't want to be how they predicted to me as a failure for a brain injury for going to college. My grades started low freshman year, fall semester freshman year, because I didn't really study that much and I didn't do my homework really. And I actually had to think of high school, it's for free, but college you have to pay for it. So I realized that and started buckling down and concentrated more on schoolwork.
Evan's math teacher, Amy Switek, spoke of him as a student in regards to his personality in the classroom.
In the classroom, I think he's a little quieter. The classes that I had him for, it was more of his first experience at King's, so students do tend to change over their 4 years here. Outside of the classroom, he was much more forward, you know, in terms of joking around and talking and things. In the classroom, he was very focused on paying attention and writing down what he needed to and trying to get all of the pieces in line so that he knew he was going to have a struggle and he wanted to make sure he had as much information as he could in class. So he was quieter in class, although he did, of course, volunteer to go to the board and things like that, but not in a very extravagant manner, let's say. I think that Evan is very proactive and upfront with letting instructors know, especially in the math area, which is that is a section that he really struggles with since his accident. So I think that he shared with me, he, you know, it wasn't that bad before his accident, but after his accident, learning math was a significant issue. So he was very upfront with me and forward with me in telling me I'm going to need some extra help and assistance. We met regularly and worked together, and it was very clear that Evan is a very hard worker and very determined in what he does.
As was a distinct part of his character, Evan's college experience was full of humor and lighthearted fun, despite the many obstacles he had to overcome. One such example is the lip sync contest he participated in.
Oh yeah, I did a lip syncing contest freshman year. I listened to the song Build Me Up Buttercup by The Foundation a few times, and my roommate noticed it. So my friend John told me that I should lip sync this song, Build Me Up Buttercup, and dedicate it towards my teacher because she builds me up saying how great my paper is, and then it turns out it's not that good. So I did a lip syncing contest. I was pretty nervous. I got all dressed up and I practiced. My friend Mike, he transferred after his freshman year. He watched it and he said I was gonna be pretty good. He told me to point in different directions to girls when the song comes up saying, oh, I need you. When that lyrics come in the song, point at different girls. So I did that. I mean, it was something I really wanted to do, a lip syncing contest, and I wasn't that good, but I got it done.
He also became active in the Marketing and Management Association, as well as being involved in two internships while studying at King's College.
The fall semester, I saw there's free pizza, so I decided to get free pizza. And it seemed like a fun club, so I stayed involved and was just a member. And then I was elected to be vice president junior year. And we didn't do much that year, which was kind of frustrating. But me and my friend Lewis, we got together and set up a fundraiser for lupus disease, which the president wanted to do. Basically, we set up a donation for lupus disease where we would do $3 a strike because it's baseball season now. And whenever someone gets a strike, $3 get fundraised towards lupus disease. And we raised, I believe, $200 or so. I mean, it was like, we raised like $200, I believe. And we went to different places like Vesuvio's Pizza, and a few other places. They donated the money, and it ended up being believe, $50 worth of strikes on the first round. So each place donated $50. And then senior year, I was the president, and we set up a fundraiser for actually the Brain Injury Association of Delaware, where we sold hot beverages and candy bars, and we raised around a little more than $200. So that was pretty good, and I think we did a pretty successful job for that. And I think it's a good thing to know how to manage and be more of a leader and be able to delegate, because I had some problems delegating, and I've definitely developed that skill better. First, my EcoCarts internship. When I was a sophomore, I had an internship with EcoCarts with Jim Abrams, I believe his name was. He was a King's graduate, and basically they were thinking about setting up a food service industry here, and basically I was a part of setting up a business and advertising and bringing awareness and letting people know about EcoCarts. And then I had another internship summer of 2012. I had an internship at the South Jersey Healthcare in their marketing and public relations department. But it was pretty fun. It was pretty fun, and it was a good learning experiment. Good learning experience on how nonprofit organizations work. So basically I had a couple things I had to do was look at an annual report. I looked at that four times, a lot of stuff I had to read, but I had to make sure there was no mistakes. I had to look over papers that was published on newspapers. I had to write for newspapers. I saw how healthcare works in the marketing and public relations department, and I'm interested in working in a healthcare industry or services that I can do marketing communications, preferably that treats brain injuries.
Sometime after he was fully recovered, the Higgins family returned to the ICU and met people who had saved his life.
We went over up to the ICU, and they looked at him, and their jaws dropped. They couldn't believe that Evan was standing there. He said, "I wanted to come back and thank you for everything that you did for me." And they said, "Oh my God!" And they made him sit down. I said, "Please, just sit down. We don't want you to fall or nothing. Just please sit down for us." He goes, "No, I can stand. No, please sit down." It's like they just couldn't believe their eyes. And then we went over to Dr. Sugarman's office, and Dr. Sugarman was astounded. He was beside himself. He could not believe that a person who, in his words, should have never lived, he'd seen people with less, not even make it, that Evan was sitting there in his office. And Evan said, "Well, you want me to do something?" And the doctor said, "Well, yeah, can you walk across the room?" So he got up and walked across the room, and he did the test, and he did pretty good on all the tests and everything. Well, although there were some deficiencies, you know. And Dr. Sugarman looked at him and said, "Evan, God gave you a second chance in life. He has something very special for you to do." He goes, "I'm going to leave you with the charge to find out what that special thing is and go do it."
Evan gave a speech at the Ronald McDonald House so that he could be able to share his story and inspire others with it.
Evan went back to the Ronald McDonald House, and he wanted to do a motivational speech. Every Tuesday night at the Ronald McDonald House, they'd have all the parents had to sit there. They go over all the rules again. They might have a special speaker or whatever, and that would be the time for it. Evan had 15 minutes to talk, and there was people there who had same operations, craniectomy, some brain injuries and things like that. And I remember these meetings. I always tried to be upbeat and help other parents, and as well as help Evan, but always be there ready to assist somebody else if they needed it. And I remember how everybody was always gloomy, and it was always because you're worn out. Basically, you're after you're over at the hospital all day long, and then you're over there, your work never ended. Just never ended. So Evan comes up and told his story and said that I used to live here, and that this is what happened to me. All these people, you could just see hope in their eyes. They were, after he's done his talk, they were all coming up to him saying, "Oh, thank you so much. Thank you. You don't know what you've done for me." And now the parents are saying, "Well, see, you can do this." "Yeah, I can do it." And all of a sudden they had hope to go on.
Through it all, Evan Higgins remains positive as he continues to look ahead.
It's kind of just history, kind of forgettable history. Like, I don't even think about it. I just have, like, so much more different stuff has come to my life. It's not that it's sad. It's just, like, it's just a distant memory. And sometimes I think about it, but I don't look at the pictures. I mean, I've looked at it, but I don't really get emotional about it. It's just, it happened. Gotta get through it. I guess you can say I'm very positive about it because I remember I would just think the next day.
You know, throughout the whole thing, I just have to give, there's not a day I don't wake up to this day where I don't tell God I love him and thank you for saving his life.
For WRKC, I am Jessica Mulligan.
Thank you for listening to Reboot, the Evan Higgins story on WRKC Wilkes-Barre.